Hello and welcome back to Even More News, the first and the only news podcast. My name's Katie Stoll.
I will not challenge any of that. My name's Cody Johnston.
Overruled. Sustained.
You're in order.
Hey, Cody.
Hi.
Just want to real quick wish you a very, very, very happy National Cookie Day.
Oh.
Yum, yum, yum.
Yum, yum, yum. I feel like we did that like a month ago or 2 months ago. There's like several cookie days, I'm sure.
There's right? very little oversight of the national holiday calendar.
We need a department of national holiday calendars.
I'm not going to fight it. I'm not mad about it. I like a cookie.
Who would you nominate for Secretary of National Holiday Calendars? Once the department is made.
Once the department is made?
Yeah. Who's your cabinet pick?
Martha Stewart.
Okay.
Who's yours?
Martha Stewart.
Ooh, unanimous approval.
Agree completely and so on.
Hey, guess what?
What?
Today's show is brought to you by our Patreon. We do not have an advertiser. and this is a great opportunity to shout out our Patreon and say thank you very much. We love you very much.
We're grateful for you.
So today's episode is a little bit different.
We're going to do voices.
No, not quite. Well, I mean, we're going to use our voices, our normal voices.
Okay.
So that is, I guess, doing a voice. Today we are joined by freelance journalist Neil Hauer, who is currently in Armenia covering the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Some of you guys follow me on Twitter and probably saw me tweet about this, but I've been really disturbed by the lack of awareness and coverage of this conflict in the American mainstream media. It's probably not just in America. I'm sure it's everywhere. The coverage is limited.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to take the time to highlight what's happening over there here on our show. So we're really grateful that Neil took the time to speak with us. It's not my most eloquent interview, but
it is now good.
Thank you. It's just early in the day for us. I was explaining to Cody after we were done. I think I saw Conan O'Brien talk about this at one point, but there's this habit. There's this strategy, I think, in podcasting that I've acclimated to where you start talking and you don't always know where the sentence is going, but you hope that it lands in the right spot and sometimes you miss. Anyway, Nick can keep this or he can cut it, but that's my caveat for the episode.
And early morning for Katie.
Neil is excellent. So please enjoy this interview. And when you are done, support him. Check out his work. Check out the resources and the organizations that he mentions if you feel compelled to. And remember that we love you very much.
Much.
Hello. Hi again. We are very excited today because we have a first-time guest, Neil Hauer. Neil is a Canadian journalist and researcher focusing on the Caucasus, and we are very, very honored to have you as our guest. Hi, Neil. How's it going?
Thanks so much, Katie. It's going good. I mean, the war is officially over, at least, so it's easier than it was a few weeks ago.
Yeah. I want to get into all of what's happening over there, but first I want to hear a little bit of background from you. You know, tell us a little bit about your work and how you found yourself over there and like kind of your journey getting to this point.
Yeah, so I guess it's a pretty lifelong, almost that sort of journey. I mean, I did my master's degree on the Caucasus, essentially. I mean, But the former Soviet Union was interesting, and then the Caucasus with just a huge mix of different cultures and languages and peoples and a huge amount of history in a small region. I thought it was the most interesting corner of the former Soviet Union.
Can you define for us what the Caucasus are for the layman out here who might not have a specific idea?
Sure. So this is essentially a region that's, you know, on the borders of Iran, Turkey, and Russia. And basically all of it is a part of the former Soviet Union. And you have three countries in the South Caucasus, Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. And then in the north, you have a bunch of regions that are still part of Russia, including Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia, and a few others.
Thank you for that. As I have mentioned, we are a news show that primarily focuses on American politics. But over the past few months, I've been horrified by what's happening between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and frustrated by the lack of reporting on it here in the mainstream media. Most of the information that I have has been pieced together by following people such as yourself on Twitter, speaking with my Armenian friends. And I know that a lot of Americans, if not most Americans, only have, you know, a peripheral knowledge at best of what's happening. And that's why we are grateful to have you here to walk us through it. I think that maybe it would be good to start with a history of the tension, kind of setting the scene for what's been going on over the past few months.
So put it this way, I mean, the roots of this conflict go back a little over 100 years to really like around the time of the end of the First World War, mm-hmm. where, you know, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan were all briefly independent, but this present conflict sort of has its roots in the breakup of the Soviet Union. And the last years of the Soviet Union, essentially, so there's a part of Azerbaijan referred to as Nagorno-Karabakh, which is majority ethnic Armenian populated. And despite this fact, it was placed by Joseph Stalin when he drew the borders of the Soviet Union, the internal borders in the early 1920s, Nagorno-Karabakh was placed inside of Azerbaijan as an autonomous region of the Azerbaijan Soviet Republic. And so, long story short, this was always an issue. And then in early 1988, it really exploded into a major issue as Soviet Union was starting to come apart. And there was a mass movement in Armenia, the Armenian Soviet Republic, and in Nagorno-Karabakh itself to join the territory to the Armenian Soviet Republic. Mm-hmm. And this precipitated a whole series of events where shortly afterwards, you know, you had pogroms that occurred inside the Azerbaijani Soviet Socialist Republic against Armenian residents. And in the capital of Baku and the town just to the north called Sumgait, you had about 200,000 or 300,000 Armenians who were ethnic Armenians who were forced out of there. And then this sparked, you know, essentially ethnic strife for the next 2 years. And after the Soviet Union collapsed and Armenia and Azerbaijan became independent, this morphed into a full-scale state-on-state war where Armenia and Azerbaijan fought each other from 1991 to 1994. And over the course of this war, the Armenians ended up controlling not only Nagorno-Karabakh itself, the ethnic Armenian region, but they also conquered 7 surrounding regions of Azerbaijan proper, which were ethnically ethnically Azerbaijani populated, and that population was expelled. And that was the situation from 1994 until September 27th of this year.
This area that was historically Armenian was given over to Azerbaijan. And then we've got some back and forth of people like have building up homes and then being forced to be expelled from their homes, from their communities, basically. This back and forth between the ceding of power.
And if you look at the map, it's like Nagorno-Karabakh, it's in the middle of Azerbaijan. It makes no sense to even look at in terms of like the history you're describing, mm-hmm. like why it would, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, the borders are very nonsensical. And I mean, in a lot of the ways you look at like the center borders in Central Asia and the Soviet Union and the same sort of way. You know, they're drawn, as many people speculate, in order to intentionally create problems like this.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting, the idea of to intentionally create conflict. And I think maybe we'll get around to some of that later. But this basic outlining of it is already so tragic to think of generations of people continuing to be displaced over and over again in this tension simmering for such a long period of time. I'm curious why that decision in the first place happened to create that pocket there, even though it didn't make sense for the borders. But I don't know that you have any information on that specifically.
Yeah, the commonly accepted version of it is that the borders were essentially drawn in the early 1920s, and that this was part of the borders being drawn in this way were part of the Soviet treaty with Turkey, the newly emerging Republic of Turkey, and the treaty they signed in 1920. And there's a lot of impact from that treaty, the Treaty of Moscow, on the borders of the region. And that's the region why that's the reason why Georgia has this autonomous region as well. Georgia, mm-hmm. just being to the north of Armenia, has this autonomous region on the border with Turkey called Adjara. And this same thing sort of happened in Armenia and Azerbaijan. I mean, there's the other area. If you look at the map in Armenia, or to the west of Armenia, there's a small exclave of Azerbaijan called Nakhchivan. Mm-hmm. And Nakhchivan, 100 years ago, was ethnically mixed between Armenian and Azerbaijani. But as a result of this treaty, as part of that, it was given to Azerbaijan to be under Turkic control, so as to not upset Turkey, which the Soviets were doing the treaty with. And this is a lot of the same reason why the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is you know, physically disconnected from Armenia by a small margin, but vast majority 100 years ago, 90% Armenian population was placed inside of Azerbaijan's Soviet Socialist Republic.
Oh, it's all incredibly complicated. Now fast forward to 2020, when everything goes off the rails. Can you walk us through what's been happening, but also the buildup to how this started, this most recent conflict?
Right. So essentially what you've had is, you know, the conflict ended with a decisive Armenian military victory in 1994 after the wake of the Soviet collapse. And there has been different initiatives, different sets of negotiations to try and resolve this conflict since then, but they've all come to naught, and there hasn't been anything super serious in about 10 or 15 years. And essentially over the last 15 years, you know, since the current president of Azerbaijan came to power in 2003, Ilham Aliyev, and that's around the same time that Azerbaijan's oil revenues started to explode, and they started to reap the rewards of having their offshore oil fields. And so essentially over the last 15 years, Azerbaijan has used that oil revenue to build up their armed forces massively, to the point where they're outspending Armenia 10 to 1 on their military for a number of years. And that is something that occurred over, especially in the mid-2010s, and then it all essentially boiled over into this year, where there were some skirmishes in July, and then essentially, you know, it was not only the right time for Azerbaijan, having spent all this money, and, you know, the world's attention was on COVID, and the U.S. attention was on the election, but also Turkey came in and fully supported Azerbaijan diplomatically, as well as flying a bunch of advanced drones for them and providing them command and control officers on the ground. And so all these factors sort of came together to the point where Azerbaijan and Ilham Aliyev, the president, decided essentially that on September 27th that they were tired of diplomacy and that they were going to resolve this question by force and try and regain Karabakh by force. And they started a military offensive.
So when I'm reading about this, it seems like there's a lot of passing the buck of, you know, from Azerbaijan army. There was skirmishes and Armenia fired, you know, shot down a plane or something to that effect. And then Azerbaijan retaliated tenfold with tanks and artillery. And it does seem, and as how you have just explained it, that all of these things were set up in just such a way for the right moment when they can justify the use of their force. But I don't know if that's just me interpreting it the way I'm interpreting it.
No, that's pretty correct. I mean, there's a clearly established sequence of events, and, you know, laid out. Empirically in the reporting that shows Azerbaijan preparing for this offensive since July, but then especially in the weeks leading up to it. I mean, then just the week or two before this war broke out, Azerbaijan, they called up all their reservists, they requisitioned civilian vehicles, and then 48 hours before the war started, the U.S. embassy in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, sent out a warning to U.S. citizens not to travel outside of the area of Baku, which is unprecedented and a clear sign that they were tipped off. And so there's a significant, and also, you know, these Syrian mercenaries who we now know arrived in Azerbaijan about a week or two before the war kicked off. So there's a clear set of evidence showing that Azerbaijan had planned this war carefully and then executed it.
And has Turkey always been an ally or supported Azerbaijan?
They have. They've always been an ally, but certainly nothing close to the degree which they have been in the last 6 months. Yeah, exactly. They've largely been like a rhetorical ally. I mean, Turkey cut their own diplomatic relations with Armenia in 1993 over this war, and they've been closed ever since. I mean, the border between Turkey and Armenia is sealed. And so they've always been a pro-Azerbaijani, but nowhere near the actual tangible, physical level of support in the last few months.
Definitely seems like there's something in their best interest here. Also, I guess we'll get into this a little bit later when we talk about the peace treaty that has been brokered this week, I believe. I know that Russia also is playing a hand in this.
Right. Yeah. So the peace deal came down about 3 weeks ago on the early hours of November 10th. And essentially it was what it essentially reads like is that Russia came in and imposed a peace upon Armenia and Azerbaijan. And, you know, you go there and you see the amount of Russian peacekeepers there, and it reinforces this perception of, you know, the kids were playing, fighting with each other. And then the rest of the adult in the room comes in and says, okay, guys, you're done. You had your 45 days of fun. Azerbaijan, you win, but you're not making a full military victory here. And now there's at least 2,000 Russians on the ground in Karabakh with all the panoply of military equipment that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is there like a timeline there in terms of like how long they will be there? Or is it just, well, we're here and then we'll see?
I mean, the official wording of this document is that the Russians will be there for an initial term of 5 years, and then as long as neither Armenia or Azerbaijan vetoes that in 6 months before the expiration, that it'll automatically extend. But the overwhelming feeling is that the Russians, you know, Russian peacekeepers, once they arrive in an area, they don't tend to leave.
Right.
And I think very few people expect that the Russians will just pack up and take off at the end of this, especially because the main political problem here is still at square one, the status of Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, right. Armenia lost a lot of the surrounding areas. Azerbaijan retook those militarily, but the core area, the Armenian populated area, it's still outside of Azerbaijani control, now under Russian protection.
Okay.
There is no indication of what the status of that will be. There's been no progress made on that.
Right, that's the issue. Like, the actual problem has not really been
the core issue. I mean, there was also the issue of the surrounding seven occupied regions of Azerbaijan, that's resolved now. Azerbaijan has either reconquered those or they've just been handed back in the last few weeks under the deal. But the remaining territory, the actually Armenian populated territory that wasn't retaken by Azerbaijan, remains unresolved. You know, this is still de jure. If you look at lines on a map, it's part of Azerbaijan from the Soviet era borders. But they don't control it, and they're not close to controlling it, and the status is unresolved, as it has been for 25 years.
Yeah, it still looks like a cut-up mess.
But what this does for Russia is give them a foothold in the region, I would assume, and increase their power. Because what this is basically doing is, you know, you're weakening Armenia, and they're creating a dependence upon Russia for support.
I mean, Armenia has always been, itself has always been in this position. Sure. I mean, it's been a treaty ally of Russia for 25 years, and in large part to forestall any possibility of Turkish attack on it. I mean, there's a Russian military base with 3,000 guys on it and a bunch of equipment in western Armenia near the border with Turkey. But now Russia has come in here, and now Russia has, this is the first, this was the last remaining frozen conflict zone in the former Soviet Union, where Russia did not have troops present. It didn't have, it had wanted troops to be in Nagorno-Karabakh mm-hmm. for the last 26 years, but it didn't have any there now. And now it's put in, according to the deal, 2,000, but according anecdotally to what I've seen driving around there last week, I think there's 2,000 armored police or armored infantry fighting vehicles alone, let alone Russian troops.
Indefinitely, also.
How does this benefit Turkey at the end of the day, this treaty?
Turkey essentially came in, and this was Russia's backyard, and Turkey kicked the door open on this frozen conflict that had stayed in the status quo for 25 years, and they busted it open again, and they supported and enabled their ally to win a major military victory on the ground. And so now we know that, you know, Turkey's been buying, of course, oil and gas from Azerbaijan for a long time. That's not going to change as a result of this. Turkey will be sending troops to Azerbaijan in some capacity. We don't know yet if that's going to be a few guys or if that's going to be, you know, whole battalions worth of men and equipment. But Turkey has basically come into the South Caucasus and now is going to be militarily present in the South Caucasus for the first time in exactly 100 years since 1920, when they were invading then independent Armenia.
It sure seems like these major powers are benefiting from this war between these smaller countries. How is this being received by Armenians? I can't imagine well.
No, I mean, people are incredibly upset, and especially when news of the deal broke. I mean, it came via a Facebook post on the Prime Minister's page, and it sounds ridiculous, but Facebook is the medium of politics in Armenia writ large. And this was announced by the Prime Minister at 1:48 a.m. Tuesday morning, November 10th. And I remember I was getting it myself. I was coming back home at that point, and then I saw this news, and it was Tuesday early, like late Monday night, essentially. And I saw the news broke, and then within 10 minutes, you know, honking outside my apartment, and I went to the Republic Square in the center of the city, and there was a riot unfolding, and then down to Parliament, too, and the protests broke into Parliament. And, I mean, it was a shock for people, because I think most people knew that the war wasn't going great, but then suddenly to have this deal emerge that signs away 75% of the lands that they control in that area beforehand, permanently, even if a bunch of those lands had already been conquered by Azerbaijan in the last month and a half before that, this was, you know, the definitive end. And it was a big capitulation, because essentially, you know, the war happened, and everyone knew for 25 years now that the war could have happened, but they never believed that they would lose it. And it occurred 6 weeks, and they decisively lost it. And so they had to give away a lot.
So we've talked about the broad strokes of the conflict here in this peace deal, but that is kind of brushing over the actual human impact, like what's been happening on the ground and what's been happening to people. And this is going to be dark, I know, but can you tell us a little bit, like casualties, like what are some of the statistics here to start?
Right. So the official casualties or the official dead in the war is a little over 2,300 in Armenia. The real number is probably closer to 5,000. And to put that in perspective, that's the equivalent of the U.S. My math might be a little off, but it's the equivalent of the U.S. losing about 150,000 people in 6 weeks of war. I mean, it was insanely brutal. Even within the first few weeks here, everyone knew someone who had been killed on the front lines. I mean, it's a small country. It's a close-knit society. And, you know, the scale of the loss was really, you know, incredible. This was close to as many people died overall in the first war over years of combat in 6 weeks. And it was, you know, stunning for people. But it was at the same time, it was this sort of grim determination of it. If we don't have a choice, you know, we're going to fight to the end, because in Armenia, this conflict was seen as, the best way I've come to describe it to outsiders is as, you know, basically look at the map where Armenians lived a little over 100 years ago before the Armenian genocide in 1915. And what's left, where the remaining homeland is about 15% of that. And that was the area of Western Armenia that was ethnically cleansed by the Ottoman Empire, by the predecessor of Turkey. And now Turkey is directly involved in this war. And I mean, Azerbaijan is a Turkic, Azerbaijanis are a Turkic people as well. And they're fighting there too. So this was essentially seen as an existential struggle. You know, we were defending what little is left of Armenia, and we're all ready. We'll all go to the front line. We won't give an inch on this.
I mean, it's been talked about as some of the stuff that I've seen that's really disturbing you might be able to talk about. I mean, just heartbreaking stories of people burning their homes, trying to prepare for, you know, the people that are coming. And I know that there's been a lot of back and forth about, no, they burned our places of worship. No, they didn't. No, they did. And we'd love to have you talk a little bit about that whole dynamic as well.
Yeah. So to be clear, I think I'm best off putting this in a little bit of historical context from going back to the first war, and that, you know, the first war occurred in the 90s. And at the beginning of it, you know, the Armenians were very much on the back foot, and the Azerbaijanis, there's more of them, and they had more equipment and whatnot, and they were essentially indiscriminately shelling and assaulting our Armenian settlements. But then that began to change, and essentially by the end of 1992, the Armenians had secured Karabakh proper, you know, and they had gotten the land link to Armenia proper. And they had essentially succeeded in that phase of it. And then in 1993, the Karabakh Armenians in particular, not the Republic of Armenia, but the Armenians in this breakaway area, began this sort of war of conquest where they conquered the surrounding seven regions of Karabakh, the seven regions of Azerbaijan proper. and essentially drove out the population from those areas, which was ethnic Azerbaijani, some Kurdish, but about 500,000 people, what they drove out of those areas too. So it is a bit more complicated.
There's been a back and forth of control of this region. And again, like I said at the beginning, and I am totally learning everything from you, so thank you so much right now, and you're clarifying so much. But you have to think about, at that point in time in the 90s, the Azerbaijanis who were driven from their homes as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is one thought I have is that, you know, there's 4 UN resolutions against Armenia from the first conflict, and they're all related to 1993 and the conflict and the conquest of the regions surrounding Karabakh proper. And these ethnic Azerbaijani regions where, if you read the reports from these two, from the early 90s, the Western media reports on these two, and I mean, that was basically straight up ethnic cleansing too. I mean, the Karabakh Armenian militias went in there and they burned the villages down and they forced everyone out.
Yeah, that's ethnic cleansing.
Just because somebody's done it to you in the past doesn't mean it's always so hard, because we hold on to these grudges. I'm speaking generally about humans and human nature for long periods of time. But the people that you're dealing with in the 90s are not the people that created the treaty after World War One, and you know, and this people from the 90s are not the people that are living there today, necessarily.
Yeah. And it's become sort of this cycle. And, you know, as I talked to someone the other day, he said, an Armenian guy, he said, you know, we've had 2 wars now. We won the first one. We lost the second one. We got to have a third. You know, we got to figure out who's the ultimate winner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then you got to have a fourth, right? You got to go for that fourth one. And then you got it. Maybe you'll have a fifth one. You know,
Everybody loves a sequel. Yeah. But yes, could you talk a little bit about that story that some of us may have seen going around? I think it's just all tied in what you were just saying, but about people burning their homes to prevent, you know, or in the places of worship that have been destroyed.
So I speak to this from a personal point of view, and that I went 2 times to the region in the northwest, Kelbajor region, that was handed back on November 25th, and essentially, you know, they had a deadline. The initial deadline was only 5 days, and then they extended it for 10 days for people to hand it back. And I mean, the Armenians that were living there, none of them had lived there before the end of the first war. You know, this was an entirely Azerbaijani area. But then the Armenians that had resettled there, a large part of them were Armenians that had been expelled from the territory of Azerbaijan in the late 80s, early 90s. And so I interviewed one woman in the town of Kelbajor, one of about 600 civilians there. And she came there after Sumgayit. And Sumgayit was a pogrom that took place in a town a little north of the Azerbaijani capital in 1988. And essentially, mobs of Azerbaijanis went door to door and found the Armenians there and either killed them or forced them to flee. And that was about 200,000 people. And so this woman had come there with her family, with her grandparents. Her parents had both been killed. Her parents and her brother had both been killed in the pogrom 32 years ago, and she had been living there ever since then. And she said, you know, I'm living here. I have 6 sons. All of them went to the army. You know, one of them didn't come back, was just killed in this war. And the other 5, I gave everything I had. You know, my family fought with every drop of blood for this land. And then this land in particular, this territory, wasn't conquered. And now we have to leave again. And now we're being uprooted. They didn't tell us anything except you have to get up and go. And in 5 days, you have to be gone. Otherwise, the Azerbaijanis are coming here and they will kill you. And so there you go. It's the cycle repeated in just the course of one family. And this is one story of so many from this conflict.
Absolutely gutting. And I keep getting, throughout this conversation, there's so much that I'm learning from you here today. Frustrated at our lack of information here. And I know that we've been busy with American politics. I know we've had a big election, but it's important. That's an understatement that we know what's happening and we're aware of this. Also, this is not happening in a vacuum. COVID is very real there as well. I would love to hear from you what the COVID situation is like on the ground there.
Yeah, I mean, COVID went from being the story of the day to something that didn't even make the news. You know, And I think I my feeling here is that essentially everyone just had it. There was a period about a month ago where almost all of my friends here, which is a few dozen people, had COVID, came down with it. And I'm not sure if I had it myself. I had a day or two around that time where I felt sort of not perfect, but who can say? But essentially COVID ran rampant here too. And of course you can imagine in Karabakh itself, I mean, a lot of people left, and the ones that stayed were crammed into shelters in the basements of their apartment buildings. And so that was COVID central too. I mean, journalists went in there and got COVID, and you couldn't avoid it. And COVID was also running rampant through the army, the Armenian army that was in the trenches too. And it was just this extra, you know, horrific human catastrophe on top of all the rest of it. And that you're fighting this full scale state-on-state war. I mean, the state-on-state war is already rare enough that this is one of, I can think of two others in the course of this century. One of them, of course, also is in this region, Georgia and Russia in 2008. But this full-scale war, and on top of that, you have COVID happening as well.
It's unimaginable. Has the death toll from COVID been high over there?
I don't think it's been brutally high. Although, I feel like there's been a lot that slipped through the cracks in terms of statistics. Because, you know, everything was obviously focused on the military effort, and the hospitals were already full, just with wounded soldiers instead. And I have multiple friends, you know, whose parents were in the hospital with it. They made it through. But this thing was going on just parallel to this, just as, and it just really got lost in the shuffle of just so much existing, you know, much more present human death and suffering.
I do imagine that the actual statistics are probably very different from what's official there, but because of everything you just
said. It does look like there's just been a spike over the past like month.
Put it this way, about a month ago when they were doing the tests, so that as I understand, if you're at 3% positive tests, it's really bad. Here it was 40.
Jeez.
Wow. I know a Armenian yoga teacher here in Los Angeles who made his way over there as this was going on, you know, to speak with people, to do some Armin.
I think that's the guy my friend mentioned. I think it's a friend of a friend. Yeah.
Wow. Yes. Okay. It's a small world. Yeah. I've taken some of his yoga classes in the past, and he is also one of the people that I've been following throughout this and getting updates. And I know that he currently has COVID.
I mean, at this point, I think that the statistics are going down only because everyone's already had it, basically.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. No, this is all very fascinating and tragic. And it's the kind of thing you making sure to stay up on it, because the situation, while technically like the war is over, but the situation isn't better. Just the Russian presence there, Turkey and NATO ally involved, like it's just hard to determine what will happen next.
I mean, it's hard. So we always want to include not always, but you try to include a call to action, something that people can do if they feel so compelled right now and if they have the resources. And I am curious, in your opinion, what is the best way for people to support at this point in time? Is it with awareness? Is it with fundraising?
Aid or something.
Aid.
Yeah, I mean, aid goes a long way. I mean, there's the main fund, the All Armenia Fund, which also goes by Himnadrom. But if you look up All Armenia Fund, you'll see it, and that's been the main charitable organization. But there's a lot of other ones too, because essentially, as a result of this, you know, there's 40,000 people that have permanently lost their homes as a result of this, and we're coming into winter here. And I mean, this is a small country; it's not a wealthy country, and it doesn't have that many resources to deal with this. And I mean, society is really tight knit here, and people have been helping so much, but we're coming out of this is only the people that have lost their homes. I mean, probably close to 10,000 more people who have been killed, and the family members are dealing with that too. And so I think, things like donations and things like, and then raising awareness of this too, is that, you know, this is not resolved yet. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, frankly, if there's ever any possibility that the remaining Armenian
populated territory of Karabakh comes under Azerbaijani control, it will be a massive tragedy and a massive humanitarian disaster too. So there's been this effort going around called Recognize Artsakh, which is, you know, this filled with its own political connotations as well too. But, you know, this idea that, you know, this is not just, oh, it's within Azerbaijan's border, so if Azerbaijan conquers it all and wins the war, this is over and everyone's okay. And so this sort of idea that, you know, this is a full-scale war that just happened here for a month and a half on the edge of Europe, basically, and barely made headlines in a lot of places.
Yeah.
So being aware of just what just happened here and what the threats are to people still living in this area is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Again, very late at night for you. Early in the day for us, but we really appreciate it, and we would love to keep in touch with you and check in the future as things shift and if there's any more new developments that are happening.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much for having me on, and happy to be in touch again.
But before you go, you should tell our listeners how they can support your work and where they can find you online, because you are an independent journalist who we value very much here at our company. And so if you guys have time and money and want to support, we want to point them in the right direction.
Correct. Yes, I made the foolish mistake of entering freelance journalism, which is not a thriving industry. And you can read my stuff online at Neil Hauer, NeilHauer on Twitter. And there you'll also find the link to my Patreon account, which is patreon.com/NeilPHauer, which is NeilPHauer. And that's where I'm running. You know, I've got some extra content available for my followers. I write a weekly newsletter, and I do Q&A sessions. I make the content of my articles available ahead of time. And if you want to toss me $5 a month, $10 a month, you know, it all helps to make this a viable profession.
Awesome.
Great. I think it's reversed, actually. So Neil P. Hauer on Twitter, and then it looks like Neil Hauer on Patreon.
Oh.
I just wanted to clarify for everybody. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Go find him, you guys.
Yeah,
support his work. Thanks again, Neil. Have a great night.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
So that was that, and this is this. That was the interview, and this is the end.
Yes.
And we thank you so much for listening, and again, to our patrons, and to Neil for talking to us. And I'll just say, we love you very much.
Much!
Much!
That was weird having you say it.
I know.
But it's true.
No, you do it.
We love you very much.
Much.